As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's the little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms or restrictions apply.
The race is on, and in a few days it will be for real, with the Australian Grand Prix kicking off the first action of the 2020 Formula One season. The talking is over, the testing is over, and come Saturday afternoon in Melbourne, everyone will finally have to lay their cards on the table and we'll see how quick everyone really is. But with Mercedes looking strong in testing, might the season opener have a sting in the tail, just like it did last year when favourite Ferrari failed? I'm Ed Straw, and joining me to preview the new season are Scott Mitchell and Mark Hughes. Scott Mitchell, you're recovering from the arduousness of testing in your Stockholm bolt hole. How's it over there?
Yeah, it's not too bad, thank you. It's nice and cold. Weekend we had lovely blue skies and sunshine, but today's given way to lots of cloud and misery. So it's a little bit like being back in London, I think, but just a little bit colder.
Well, talking of people in remote locations, we've also got Mark Hughes. You're up in the north. Is it grim up north as always, or is it sunny and pleasant?
You know, Manchester, if you draw a line through the middle of the UK, it's still in the south, so I'm not that remote. And it's been raining for about 40 days. I don't know. That's the sign of the apocalypse coming, but it's stopped today, so maybe we get away with it.
We'll add that to the list of the signs of the apocalypse. Then that's that's extending a reasonable amount at the moment. But we'll let you be a southerner then on your geographical definition. That's a good way to join the club. So that makes Scott the most northerly one. So there we go. We've got that solved. Well, we've got the new season starting. Testing kind of suggested Mercedes was in pretty good shape, but it was. It was an interesting one, wasn't it, Mark? Because it wasn't quite as clear-cut as perhaps last year's was. And, of course, last year's proved not to be very effective in predicting Melbourne. But there's a few things you can slice and dice that suggest that certainly Ferrari are a lot stronger than they looked. And then there's also this sort of feeling of what Red Bull might be able to do.
Yeah, exactly. I think Mercedes of the top three teams had the most straightforward program. So they got their performance running done in mainly in the first week, actually, and then they were working away at further understanding the setup and things on the second week. The Ferrari picture is a lot more rosy than the one lap times made it look. And that was suggested by a Vettel run on the first week over a stint, but on a full race simulation on the final day for Charles Leclerc, it confirmed that picture that really they still look a little away from Mercedes, but as good as Red Bull, maybe even edging Red Bull, and well clear of the others, well clear of the so called Class B or midfield.
Yeah, but we always kind of expected, even though there were people suggesting Racing Point might be able to pick off the big three on merit, that that gap was never going to be closed down completely. I think it'll be closer, but I think it'll be another step closer, and there'll still be that chasm there. But it's interesting, isn't it, Scott? Because there is an interpretation of this that says actually we could be on for quite a close season, because you can argue either Mercedes is a chunk ahead, or you can look at some of these things and say actually those three teams could be something approaching that condensed three-way fight we want. That's probably hoping for too much, but it's that there's a lot of unanswered questions, aren't there?
Yeah, there are. I feel like it was one of those pre-seasons that we kind of thought it was going to build to this crescendo of answers in the second week, and we did get more hints and clues, but still don't feel like we know exactly what to expect. And I know pre-season testing has been a bit misleading in the past. Last year is the best example, but at least you came away from pre-season feeling like there was a fairly firm verdict. And on this occasion, I'm just with Ferrari, there's still the doubt over how honest they're actually being, because you know, their rivals are just adamant that they're not they're not behind quite how they say they are. Red Bull, you know, you had this apparent element of instability because we saw both drivers going off at different times, but they just seem so calm and confident about everything that it's a bit like, well, you know, do they have something up their sleeve that we're not expecting? And meanwhile, Mercedes just being Mercedes, racking up the laps and lapping quickly as well, but they've got this reliability spectre hanging over them because they've had a few engine problems through testing. So feels like we've got sort of different kinds of doubts about all three teams. You know, if you're taking a punt, as you suggested, it did look like Merck won the testing war, maybe with Red Bull just behind and Ferrari a little bit off, but that could quite easily change.
I think as well, Melbourne is historically not the most powerful predictor of what's going to happen. You tend to see sometimes slightly extended gaps there, and Mercedes always seem to go very strongly at Albert Park. In fact, I think throughout the hybrid era, they've always won in Melbourne, haven't they? So that's very much a circuit where they know how to do well. What do you think, Mark? Do you think we have to take with a pinch of salt almost as much as in testing anything that happens in the Australian weekend?
Yeah, obviously you always take it with a little bit of pinch of salt, but we are much better informed now than we were 2 weeks ago. We have a sort of rough, or you know, an order of magnitude idea. But yeah, Melbourne is traditionally very strong for Mercedes, and particularly strong for Hamilton. Hamilton usually blitzes it in qualifying there. So it's fairly untypical. It's, you know, road, public road surface, dusty. It's not a typical, and it's not a typical circuit, and we usually take a reading after the first sort of four or five races. Then going back to Scott's point about how honest Ferrari are being, as far as I can tell, they were using all sorts of different engine modes, but I don't think we actually saw a high engine mode, low fuel run as such from them, which is why they're behind in the headline times. But in the race runs, that tends to go away because everybody's in race mode, engine modes. And on that, they did look very competitive.
It's always tricky with the long-run analysis because that, like you say, it's harder to hide things there. But at the same time, particularly now you're into, there's all sorts of fuel concerns and engine modes, etc. It's slightly more complicated than it was, say, 15 years ago when you had the refueling era, when cars are operating in a much narrower band in terms of the race pace. So it's really hard, isn't it, to get a feeling for it. But Ferrari are very interesting because they're clearly trying to manage expectations, should we say, and make sure that they don't go to Australia expected to dominate like they did last year and then not doing it. But it's just hard to get a feel on it. I hope they've not been too concerned about hiding things, should we say, because that, you know, they can only go as quickly as they can go, can't they? I mean, you spoke to the Ferrari guys quite a bit in testing, Scott. If you had £5 to put on it as to where Ferrari would be in Australia, what would you go for?
Oh God, well, is it £5 of my money or your money?
It's £5 that you've mysteriously been handed, and you have to put it on this particular bet. And you're fine.
You just found it. You found it under the sofa. I don't know whose it belongs to.
In which case, you'll find £50 if you don't back anyone.
In which case, I would be willing to sort of side with my sort of more cynical self and not believe that Ferrari's in that much trouble. And I'd put the fibre on them to be on the podium in Australia. I'm not brave enough to put it specifically on first, second or third, but I would be surprised if they're not in the mix there. And on the subject of how much they might be trying to mislead people, I thought that something Mattia Binotto said in the final week of testing, which was, I think there is quite an element of truth to it. It's that, you know, this is Ferrari which is under a massive amount of scrutiny and pressure in Italy all the time. If they wanted to relieve pressure, then I understand why setting expectations low and then looking like heroes in Australia would help. But in the meantime, in the weeks between the car launch, when there was already noises coming out of Italy that the car was a bit behind, all the way up to Australia, you've basically got the Italian press on your back wondering if you've done a good enough job and asking why you're behind and putting pressure on you that way. So Binotto's argument was that the best way to avoid pressure is to go out and be mega from the start, and saying that they're behind is actually only going to increase expectation for them to recover and do a good job in Australia and beyond.
Well, yeah, that's one way of looking at it. But yeah, I think probably on balance, you'd say in Australia, Ferrari will have a bit of a battle to be in the mix. And I guess the real wild card is Red Bull, that there was never, like, that, from what I've seen in the times, there was never kind of a run of Red Bull that made you say, wow, actually, they could be really mega. The headline lap times were fine, although Verstappen, I think, when he was having those quick runs at the end of the final day of the test, could certainly have gone at least a few tenths quicker in the trim he was running in. But at the same time, Red Bull seemed quite optimistic, don't they? And Honda have made a good step. So what do you reckon of Red Bull, Mark? Is it going to be another season of start off behind, catch up, and then we get to the end of the year and say, oh, well, they've come on really well, so they can start next year good now? Or have they actually pulled off having a good car from the start?
No, I think they're in pretty good shape to start the season. Maybe not as fully rounded yet as Mercedes, but I don't think we're going to turn up at Melbourne and find that actually they're a second off the pace, which is what happened last year and in 2017, both times after major regulation changes. I think they'll be competitive straight off, but yeah, I'd be looking for them to develop that car, them and Honda, to develop that car to be hopefully a car that can go bat to bat with the Mercedes and fight out the championship with them. That's my hope. I don't think it's an unrealistic hope yet. But yeah, there were little glimpses of the car looking fantastic on certain types of corner. But as we've all written about, it did seem to be getting in its drivers into a lot of incidents. Or the drivers were getting into a lot of incidents with it, and seemed to be in corner entry, breaking into slow speed corners. There does seem to be something a little imbalanced about it. And I know Gary Anderson has his theory on why that might be, and it sounds quite feasible to do with how loaded the outboard end of the wing is and how you're suddenly opening up the area behind it when you put on a lot of steering lock as you do on a slow corner. And that sounds like a good working theory to explain an awful lot of incidents, but a car that's inherently pretty quick.
Yeah, it absolutely tallies with, like, through the first sector, it was looking really good, the Red Bull, but then some of the slow corners, the turn 10, obviously, and then the chicane, and just that last sector, just a little bit iffy. It's hard to tell how much of that could come down to overdoing it a bit on the tyres, particularly in that that period where Verstappen was trying the quick laps at the end of testing. But yeah, Honda have clearly made gains, so Red Bull, you're not looking too bad. But I guess we've kind of talked about the relative performance of the cars, but we've got quite a fascinating kind of driver storylines this year, haven't we? You've got Lewis Hamilton going for that record-equalling seventh world championship, which seems astonishing to say, really. We thought that Michael Schumacher record would never be threatened, let alone equaled or maybe even broken if Hamilton keeps going and still has the car. You've got the Ferrari storyline with Leclerc being on top of Vettel last year, but can Vettel hit back and earn himself a new Ferrari deal? And you've got Max Verstappen, who nobody's in any doubt can fight for the championship. I mean, for me, I'd love to see Verstappen in a championship fight, because we know he's a force of nature. He's a magnificent driver. And that sort of Hamilton, Verstappen versus, and we have to say Leclerc rather than Vettel at this stage, that's the kind of dream scenario, isn't it? And you've got three drivers there who are all really magnificent, and maybe Leclerc a bit behind in terms of his development. Just it's only his third season, but you know what a magnificent trio of drivers there we've got.
Yeah, this is one of the great periods in terms of you know, the depth of quality in the field, and the new guys coming up is extremely high quality. But we've still got Lewis from the previous generation still operating at or near his peak. So yeah, for that reason, we really, really do hope that there's going to be a more level playing field in terms of the machinery, and we can just see them fight it out, so that the outcome is determined pretty much by the quality of the drives.
Yeah, it's great when you get these kind of generational battles, isn't it? And ultimately, Lewis Hamilton at 35, he's okay. That's at the upper end of his career. He's got fewer years ahead of him than behind him, but he's still, you can at 35 still be kind of in that prime window, even if there has been any slight deterioration in some areas, more than made up for by the experience. And what we have seen from Hamilton is just that great ability in recent years to just, particularly the last 3 years or so, I think 2016, he learned quite a big lesson in terms of how you go about making sure you win a championship. Just good judgment, knowing when to fight his battles, nailing key passes when he has to, backing out of things when he knows that it's not worth taking the risk. But Scott, I guess what we really want to see is if we can see Hamilton consistently challenged, then there'll be more questions asked of him, shall we say. You know, he's a magnificent driver, but you just wonder what happens when particularly Verstappen and Hamilton go head-to-head, and then we see Verstappen in a situation where he's not just sniping for the odd win, he's got to think about the championship as well. So he can't necessarily always get away with doing these sort of late moves that maybe require a tiny bit of accommodation, shall we say, from the driver he's battling with.
Yeah, it will be really interesting for Hamilton's side, Verstappen's side, but also, you know, Leclerc as well, if he's in the mix, because we saw last year, you know, Monza was a good example of Leclerc getting aggressive and maybe even overstepping the mark under braking for the second chicane. And Hamilton even said, you know, if he wasn't going for the title, he doesn't move, and they have a clash. And on the Verstappen side of things, I just get the impression that I don't think Lewis quite knows how to go wheel to wheel with Verstappen in an even fight, because every time that's happened, it was all well and good in Brazil last year. Lewis said, you know, gloves are off, title's done, so I'm going to go out properly. But it's kind of like, that's still different. If the title's wrapped up, that's not the same mentality as with the title on the line against your rival. I think you race differently. So the idea that we've not seen Hamilton go up against these guys in genuinely even circumstances, that's what makes this year so fascinating, because I want to see that. I want to see that sort of, whether it's the changing of the guard or seeing if Hamilton can rise to the occasion and just prove that, you know, there's still life in the old dog. Yeah, it's a little bit like when we saw Alonso and Schumacher doing battle in the mid-noughties, and I would just love to see what happens. See, has Verstappen got the restraint to manage that situation properly? Is this where we maybe see, because Lewis has always been very, very good at avoiding the dark arts, but is he going to need to sort of work out how close he can go to the limit against Verstappen and Leclerc? Is that going to be part of what he has to add to his arsenal? So it's fascinating. It's arguably the biggest unknown going into the season, how those three drivers will actually engage with each other on track if the title's on the line.
It's one of those years that if the car performance allows it, it's set up for some titanic battles, isn't it, Mark? Because you feel like Hamilton and Verstappen will have to, if they're in a title fight, they'll have to have some kind of showdown. Then you've got the potential for some kind of on-track clash. And almost the same with Verstappen and Leclerc as well. You know, we saw them getting quite racy, particularly after Austria last year. So it's just sort of this tinderbox that could go off, particularly with the fact you've got Hamilton knowing that he has to fight off this next generation, who he knows will knock him off his perch eventually, but he wants to stay up there as long as he can.
Yeah, exactly. It's got many dimensions, this battle. If we get three equally matched cars, or three cars that can race each other, because you're talking about how does Lewis race Max? Does he have to make a stand and say no, I'm not moving, or I'm going to have the accident? It's okay saying that when the other guy is your only competition, but when there's a third guy that you might be letting through in doing that, It changes the dynamic again. And yeah, as you say, in these sort of contests, these generational turning type of contest, it is ultimate. History says it's always the younger guy that eventually prevails, but it doesn't have to be yet. There's no saying when that is. It might be now. It might be 3 or 4 years' time. And that's watching the sort of the king of the pride, sort of trying to keep his place off the young pretenders is one of the great recurring storylines of the sport. And we're very well placed to see an epic version of it. But as long as those three cars, or at least two of them, can, you know, race each other on equal terms.
Yeah, that's the unknown at this stage. And it's interesting as well, because sometimes these sort of generational battles, we get frustrated because a driver either retires or going back in time, sometimes we've lost drivers at Keem. Obviously, we never quite saw the Schumacher-Senna battle play out properly. And, you know, there's plenty of examples of that going further back. But here, we've really got it laid out in front of us, which is why I really hope the things will be similar. How do we see Sebastian Vettel's role in all of this? Because people always say, oh, a driver like that's got nothing to prove, four times world champion, etc. But he has got everything to prove, hasn't he? He's got to show he can do it against this younger generation. He's got to show he can cut out the mistakes. He's got to show he can earn another Ferrari deal. And on current trajectory, I would say if he has another year like last year, particularly if there's problems with things like the collision with Leclerc, which I think in Interlagos, despite what Ferrari might have said publicly, I think we all would agree that was a Vettel error. If that happens again, he's not going to be staying there beyond this year, is he? So this is a guy fighting for his career, and a guy who at his best is absolutely stunning. So what do you expect from Vettel, Mark?
He's got it all to do, as you say. He's fully capable of springing a surprise out of nowhere. And I think we saw in qualifying in Japan last year, he suddenly just pulled a lap out of the bag that left Leclerc sort of, you know, confused, because he thought he'd done a great lap. So Seb he's got great depth of resource, and he's incredibly competitive. And I can't imagine a situation in which he could be more motivated than he will be going into this year. But he's definitely not wired up to be a number two. I cannot imagine Seb sort of taking stock and thinking, okay, he's a tenth or so quicker than me. Over the season, he's going to beat me, so I'll just do the best I can and still have a nice time. He talks about he still loves the car, he still loves driving, still loves competing, but there's an element of Seb that is just going to be deeply, deeply hacked off if he finds himself falling into the number two role. And it's going to be very, very difficult to go against someone of Leclerc's caliber with all that energy behind him, and you sense the team more behind him than behind Seb, to do that over a season, race after race after race, to be competing on level terms, and then you go into a weekend not knowing which of them is going to be the quicker guy. I think that's a very difficult program for Seb to put together in the circumstances that he's facing.
Could be a difficult situation for Ferrari to manage as well. But I think with Seb, you know, he's publicly, he sort of tries to play all of this down, doesn't he? He says, well, yeah, you know, mistakes happen, etc. But we have seen drivers in the past who are really ruthless, and they have got that single-mindedness to do something that's a mistake, that's stupid, that they shouldn't do, say no, it was fine, and you know they believe it. But I almost feel that Seb's too, he's almost wired up too normally to really do that. And I get the feeling he sat there saying, sort of telling himself, right, this isn't a problem, this isn't my mistake. But, you know, he'll look at what happened in Interlagos and think, oh, what did you do that for? Because he just loses, he falls out of that.
It's just a split-second competitive panic is the trait we've seen over the last 2 or 3 years.
Yeah, that's a great way to describe it. And I don't think he knows how to do it. I think he's going into the season doing his level best. The motivation's there, but I just don't know whether the Ferrari environment is right. What do you make of it, Scott? Because Red Bull got a lot out of Vettel. He had a great relationship with his race engineer, Guy Roquelin, who seemed to help keep him in a window most of the time. But you know, would you back Seb to make something of this? We heard Mattia Binotto saying I forget the phrase he used, but it's basically keeping Seb as his first choice. But that, I think, implies a question of my first choice is Seb delivers at the level we know he can do consistently and stops messing it up so that we can keep him.
Yeah, because I think the level that Seb's operated at times over the last 2 years, it just isn't
befitting of a guy who should command a top seat in Formula One. And that's not to say that Seb has not been good enough over the last two or three seasons to race for Ferrari. It just means that, like, when he's had his bad days, my God, have they been bad days. So it's been a bit tricky for him. I think he can rise to the occasion this year, but I think a lot of it will depend on the quality of the car. And I think it will depend on Leclerc's trajectory as well, because the big difference that I see with Vettel at Ferrari compared to Red Bull, obviously I wasn't there to judge Vettel in his Red Bull days, but the impression I get from everything I've heard and read from the likes of you two is that Vettel had that environment where it was just king of the castle. And in Ferrari, not only does he now not have that undeniable number one status because of Leclerc's quality and the way he adapted to the rigors of driving for Ferrari last year, you've also got a car that's not best suited to him, perhaps. You've also got an environment that doesn't necessarily do a lot to keep its drivers' emotions under control. We heard plenty of times last season how much Leclerc got rumbled during Grand Prix or qualifying sessions because he wasn't being given the information he needed. So Ferrari's just got that little element. I feel like Ferrari's always running at a higher percentage of chaos than any of the other top teams. And when you've got emotional drivers, I don't think that's conducive to getting the best out of them. So I don't think the Ferrari environment is necessarily as compatible with Vettel as his Red Bull days were. That's not to say that it can't get like that and you can't still get the best out of him, but that would be my theory as to why you don't necessarily see Vettel at that peak all of the time.
Yeah, I think that's fair. He was magnificent at times during that Red Bull spell, and, you know, particularly in the blown diffuser days, he was able to just make the car do amazing things when he was in that zone. But yeah, it just doesn't seem to be quite in the right headspace. Let's take a very brief break, and then we'll be back with more top team chat before we move on to the midfield runners. Well, Mark Hughes, let's turn to you to talk a little bit about Charles Leclerc, because we haven't perhaps got into him in terms of whether we think he can go toe-to-toe with Verstappen and Hamilton at this stage and win. It's only his second season in a top team. We've seen what he can do. He's a magnificent driver and there's a world champion in there, no question. Is it too early for him, all things being equal, again, with the factor about the cars? Do you think he could come out of a season against Hamilton and Verstappen on equal terms and win?
I think he's ready going into this season. I think we saw last season still a little ghost of the patchiness that was there in his rookie seasons, but it's, I don't think, an inherent trait. I think it's just a case of the data banks filling up. Still a little bit. Last year was still, you couldn't guarantee he was going to be absolutely magnificent coming into a weekend. But when he was, he really was. And he sometimes got the impression he was hanging on a little bit by his fingernails. You know, that spectacular quali lap in Singapore being a case in point. But when you looked at that lap, it was absolutely stunning in terms of the commitment and the millimeters he was leaving between the wall on the approach to corners. Even compared to Lewis, he was giving it, you know, probably 3 millimeters instead of one. He was so committed, and then he has had a huge moment through the bridge. Somehow manages to hang on to it, and still got momentum, and still, it's that sort of exciting performance that you, when you're watching a great talent come into flower, and it's probably a little bit less exciting when you see it all rounded and composed. And I think we're probably going to see a more rounded, composed Leclerc this year. And if the car is up to it, and if the team operations are up to it, he's absolutely capable of fighting for a title, yes.
I think it's just a question of those tiny little final sort of 0.5%. Actually, another example from Singapore, more on the negative side. There was a phase in the race, once he'd lost the lead through no fault of his own, to Ferrari accidentally undercutting Vettel past him. There was a phase when they came through the traffic. I think it would have been Giovinazzi who led briefly. So there was a racing point in there. I forget exactly who it was, but Vettel, through that lapping phase, pulled quite a lot of time on Leclerc, which was interesting. It was something massive, like 5 seconds or something, which was pretty amazing. Although that may have been because Leclerc was busy being furious as well, which doesn't help. But no, I think I think you're right. We will see Leclerc in the narrow window. It's just those key decision moments where you've kind of got to make that sort of thrusting move, which we've seen Hamilton is great at. I guess the classic example was Sochi in 2018 when strategy drops in behind Vettel. And on a track where it's not easy to overtake, he managed to then nail Vettel to retake the win, which I thought was a brilliant example of what Hamilton can do. We should also talk about the other two top team drivers that we've kind of discounted from this title argument so far. One of them in Valtteri Bottas at Mercedes, I think would be a little bit irritated at that as he sees himself as a title contender. Alex Albon at Red Bull, only in his second season, so I think his targets are a little bit different to fighting for the championship, although I'm sure he'd love to if he does it. Let's take Bottas first, Scott. I mean, he's talking about being even better this year. We saw how he stepped forward last year, but he still didn't quite have that consistency, as he admitted, to be there with Hamilton, and there was quite a big gap in the end in terms of points. So great season from Bottas, his best in Formula One, and yet still there's that gap to Hamilton. And regardless of anything else, if he wants to win the World Championship, he's got to beat Hamilton in equal equipment, regardless of what goes on with Verstappen or Leclerc or Vettel or whoever. So what about Bottas?
Well, there is this lingering question mark over whether Bottas, who is undoubtedly good enough to win races and control races and score great pole positions when the car's mega. But the doubt remains when the other guys are in the mix. So when the Ferrari's on song and or the Red Bull's on song. Because if you take that top six, if everyone was equal, Bottas on his day is capable of being incredibly, incredibly quick. But we know that his weakness is really in races. He doesn't seem to be able to force the issue enough. And I fear that he ends up not only behind Lewis, but behind Max and Charles and maybe even Seb as well. So it's difficult, really. He does need to make that step. He talked last year about having a plan to beat Hamilton, but I've pretty sure that plan basically boils down to I've got to stop cutting out the inconsistencies and the little errors, because Lewis is just so relentless. It doesn't really afford an opportunity for Bottas to just sort of walk away. The idea that Bottas could ever manage a sort of points advantage that Rosberg has had when him and Hamilton were together, I can't see that happening. I can't see Bottas resorting to the dark arts that Rosberg employed to get under Hamilton's skin. I don't think Hamilton's necessarily as vulnerable to it either. And then you've got more external factors like the other teams, as I mentioned, that I just think can catch Bottas out. So I don't want to completely dismiss him as a title prospect, but I think he's got to hit the ground running. He's got to prove that he can get on top of this car very, very quickly, not lose ground to Hamilton early on, but also he absolutely has to step it up on race day, because if the title is as close as we think it could be this year, then the championship will be decided on whether or not you turn fourth and fifth place finishes into second and third place finishes.
Yeah, unfortunately, I think with Bottas, we saw last season, we saw a lot of good, but there were just examples of where it wasn't quite as good as it could have been. Oh, Germany was a bit of a missed opportunity. Hungary, although on first impression, like it was Leclerc's fault, Bottas did have his part in that collision on the first lap. Silverstone, where Bottas couldn't even think about doing the one-stop strategy that won it for Hamilton. Obviously, the safety car intervened, but it was going to win it for Hamilton anyway. Italy, when Hamilton spent the race harrying Leclerc, and then when his tyres were off, Bottas had a tyre advantage but couldn't bring the same pressure. And you don't often see Bottas doing these kind of turnaround victories. I guess the closest was probably Austin last year when he had that tyre advantage over Hamilton and he came through and passed him. And although on paper that was one of those sort of easy things to do, quite often we see Bottas with a tyre advantage in the past not be able to make up those things. So what do you think of Bottas, Mark? Is he basically there as a very good support act to Hamilton?
He's very good, and it would be interesting to see how he compared with a different teammate in a top car. I was thinking back to Baku last year, and his opening lap there was just magnificent. And I think if he can ever get himself into that space, he can just go, and he can look magnificent. He's fully capable of dominating a race, but it has to be in a narrow band of circumstance for him. He's not as good with the tyres as Lewis. He's very, very meticulous in understanding where Lewis gets the advantage and where he can improve his own driving. But, and then he just as he does that, Lewis will invent a different way of doing it. And again, he's always seems to be a step behind. He started last year very strongly. I suspect partly because the race engineering side on his side of the garage had been boosted by the staff change there, and it took Lewis a while to recover because it was a guy that Lewis worked very closely with. Suddenly, Valtteri had the benefit of all the things that they'd worked out together, so Lewis had to work out a different way of competing against him. That's what I mean. Lewis always finds a way, whereas Valtteri's the guy that's methodically doing his homework to be better and better and better and better, and then you know Lewis comes in and he'll just do it a different way. So it's very hard to compete against that. And after season after season after season, you do wonder if he's not at some level sort of accepted that this is the best it's going to get.
Yeah, it's very difficult in that situation when you look across the garage and you've got Lewis Hamilton sat there. It's a similar thing to being up against Max Verstappen for Alex Albon, I guess. What do you make of Alex, Mark? I mean, he was impressive last year. I liked his ability to recover from the odd crash. He turned in some really good race performances, and it was a really good first season, I would say. But up against Max Verstappen, he's got a huge challenge on his hands in only his second season. So I think we need to see him closer to Max, don't we? That's the key. Not necessarily on Max's pace, because that's a pretty hard target, but he needs to be closer than he was last year.
Yeah. Considering that was his rookie season, it's very easy to forget that was his rookie season, especially in the second half when he was in a Red Bull. It was pretty impressive, really. But it was, as you would expect, it was peaky. And there were times where he was just, too far up, too far off Max to be comfortable. And, you know, you got Dr. Marco always looking over your shoulder thinking, is that 3/10, 4/10 off? That's, we need to be thinking about putting somebody else in this car. You've always got that pressure. So this is a massive test for him. He's really got to hook those peaks up a bit better this year. And thinking of his qualifying lap in Suzuka last year, where he matched to the 100th, Max, on a place he'd never been to before, on a real driver's circuit. That's the level he's ultimately capable of. He's got to work out how to access it much more consistently. He's not going to challenge Max over a season at the moment, but he's got to at least get himself in a position where it looks feasible, where he might be able to do it in the future.
Yeah, and I think we know there's a real driver in there. He's quick. He's good in race conditions. He can pass. Probably his best drive, actually, I thought last year was Hockenheim, funnily enough, which was overshadowed because his teammate Kvyat was on the podium. But Albon, actually,
yeah, there were a couple of late gambles there by others that knocked him off the podium. A gamble that he couldn't afford to take because he was already well placed. He should have been on the podium in the Toro Rosso.
Yeah, exactly. And I think probably that day, actually, Albon's was the best drive of anyone because he didn't make mistakes. And I think that was the first time he'd driven a Formula One car in the wet as well. So,
yes, it was
pretty astonishing for him. I think he did have one brief off at the hairpin early on when everyone was sliding off. So we'll forgive him that. But there's a driver in there. It'll be interesting to see his progress. So we'll take a quick final break and then we'll be back with lots of midfield chat. So Scott Mitchell, the midfield is traditionally very congested. We've suggested that probably that gap will still be there, even if it's closer. The feeling from testing was Racing Point are in very good shape. McLaren up there, Renault a few question marks over, AlphaTauri looking solid. Those seem to be the four sort of teams that we tentatively have at the front of an albeit very congested midfield. So what do you expect? Do you think it's going to be Racing Point and the pink Mercedes leading the way early on, or is there a bit more to be said on that one?
I would like to see a little bit more of what Racing Point's car will be like when we actually get to Melbourne and we get to that race weekend, because I feel like the direction they've gone in, like copying another car, is not quite the same as copying someone's homework, where you literally just have to fill in a few details on a page. So there is a lot more nuance to it, and I just wonder if they've obviously had a very good start. It's all looked pretty smooth, and the car does look quick. Just wonder if that will translate exactly when we get onto a track when there are other variables and that sort of thing. But
as it stands, my expectation is that we're going to have a quite controversial leader of the midfield in Racing Point. We know that the rival's position on that car is basically don't like it but have to go along with it because it isn't illegal. It's just not exactly how they think you should go about designing a Formula One car. And then you've just got this absolute mass of teams trying to work out like where they sit and how close they'll be or if they'll be ahead of Racing Point in McLaren and Renault and AlphaTauri as well, which I was not entirely sure about after the first week of testing, but everything I saw and heard about that team and from that team in week two actually suggests that they're looking quite good. So yeah, very, very, very congested. I think a smaller gap to the big three teams. And as you said, there's a couple of people that would have you believe that Racing Point might even be trying to snipe for Ferrari early on. I'm not entirely convinced that's going to happen, but hey, it would be pretty good, wouldn't it, if we saw Racing Point fighting for maybe a podium in Melbourne in shock conditions. We've seen some slightly random Australian Grand Prix before, so stranger things have happened. And we know that that team and Sergio Perez they're pretty good experts, aren't they, at sniffing out a podium in unlikely circumstances.
Yeah, well, Perez, we know how good a midfield operator he is. He's a brilliant executor of races, and although qualifying's not, he's not one of the best, very best qualifiers in Formula One. He normally has a solid qualifying record. But it's interesting, Mark, isn't it? Because there's this whole question mark with Racing Point over the second driver in Lance Stroll, who's had his moments, but he's had three seasons in Formula One now, and he's still not really shown signs of consistency. Just tiny errors in qualifying mean that he's often starting a bit further back. So is he a driver, if that Racing Point is just at the front of the midfield, that can help them to fourth? Or is all the pressure on him to raise his game and show that he's capable of week in, week out, doing what Perez does and racking up sevenths, eighths, ninths in a very congested part of the field?
Yeah, I think of even more importance in terms of where Lawrence Stroll sees that team going and the vision he has for that team of you know, in its Aston Martin guys from 21, of expanding it and making it, you know, one of the top teams. Even though it's his son, Lance is going to have to justify his place in there. And at the moment, his performances aren't at a level, consistent level, that would do that. So I think there's some potential in there, but he's got to hook it all together and it much more effectively than he did last year. Last year's car was a particularly difficult one for his way of driving. So this one looks a bit more compliant. So it might be that it's a better foundation for him to make progress with. Don't think he's going to threaten Perez over the season, but the car, I mean, from what we've seen, I would say it's probably the best of that midfield, or the second, the best of the rest. Very closely matched by McLaren in testing. The Renault not far behind either, actually, but not over a race stint. But they're all saying we've got a lot of performance to put on the cars for Melbourne, so we'll see what the picture looks like there. But it's an incredibly good racing team, and I think, you know, when over the years, one of the things that many people in the paddock have said when we've been watching, say, Ferrari have a lot of operational difficulties with a very fast car, people say if Racing Point was running that car, it would be winning the championship. And it is that good. They do great strategies. The pit stops are always spot on. It's a very, very sharp operation. So I'm expecting a lot from that team this year.
Yeah, well, when you consider they got those back-to-back fourth places in the Constructors in 17 and 18. 18, they were particularly mighty. I think each driver on their own would have been fourth in the Constructors' Championship. But that team was still struggling financially in that point as well. So, you know, defeating much, much better off outfits. So with that resource there now, they should be in a good place. I think the point you make about the car changing, obviously, because they've copied the Mercedes effectively, it is a more benign car now. It's some of those foibles that have made it a bit harder to drive seem to have been eliminated. So that could help Stroll. But it's interesting that dynamic with the other midfield battlers, because if you look at their driver lineup versus McLaren with Sainz and Norris versus Renault with Ricciardo and Ocon, you almost say that the Racing Point driver lineup is less potent, primarily because of Stroll, because I really rate Perez. But those other teams there have got two two sort of strong drivers who can deliver consistently, I think. So that's the big question, isn't it? Scott, what do you think of that? Do you think this could be close enough that it could come down as much to driver execution as the team performance at that part of the field?
Yeah, absolutely. Especially if it is that close, because I don't see Perez and Stroll as being the two drivers that you can rely on to absolutely nail it in qualifying. You know, Perez is going to get a good amount out of the car, isn't he? But I just don't think he has that stunning one lap in him that, say, a Sainz or a Ricciardo or an Ocon have. And even Norris, you know, showed particularly strongly in qualifying last year as a rookie. And Stroll, as you know, you've documented his woes quite well, and qualifying last year was really weak, especially that horrible run of Q1 exits in a car that was capable of being much higher on the grid. So with this generation of car that's harder than ever to follow, I think the importance of grid position is just going to be exaggerated even more. And in that situation, unless Racing Point does have a massive advantage in the race and strategy and a bit of Stroll first lap wizardry can overhaul the deficit from qualifying, I think they're going to struggle to turn the potential into points if it's that close. Because yeah, just if Renault's in the mix, I just think Ricciardo and Ocon is the best lineup of any team outside the big three. I think that's a really, really top class lineup. So you're going to need to be firing on all cylinders to dominate the midfield or lead the midfield at most races this year. And that is, if there's one question mark over Racing Point, I'd say it's the drivers, particularly in qualifying.
Yeah, Renault across the board is going to be one of the interesting stories this year. There's all the question marks about the future. You've got two drivers there kind of vying to be the leader. Ricciardo effectively deposed Nico Hülkenberg last year as the team spearhead, particularly with some fantastic race performances. The qualifying comparison was a bit tighter. It's still just in Ricciardo's favour. But yeah, Sundays he was really strong. But we know how ambitious Ocon is. And we saw in the Racing Point days when he was with Perez, there are a few moments there. So Renault's got the potential to be, you know, have a fantastic season and use all their resource and their drivers to be at the front of the midfield, or it could turn into a huge mess, couldn't it, Mark? It's right now, testing suggested it could still go either way for that team. We could be in a few months' time talking about what a tremendous recovery Renault have made and they're back on the road towards the front, or oh my God, what's going on here? This is an absolute mess.
Yeah, I mean, the initial picture painted from testing is that it's about where it was last year. And that's sort of what Alain Prost was intimating at the launch of the car, even though the team boss, Cyril Beatball, was a bit more upbeat. I can't really see that Renault's going to make the big step this year. And I think its hope has got to be, A, that it continues into the new formula in 21, and B, that the cost caps bring the others down towards them. But I don't see it punching above its weight at the moment. I don't see any sign that's changed. And they're running a car that was created by a tech department headed by two people who are no longer there, which is probably not great. You got new people betting in. So, no, I don't think this is going to... I'd like to be wrong, but I just don't see this is going to be the season in which they make that breakthrough.
I must admit, I actually fear that certainly early in the season, AlphaTauri might give them quite a bit of trouble as well. They seem to have quite a nice, solid car. You know, two decent drivers with experience under their belt. Gasly with someone who's capable of delivering a touch of magic sometimes, not so much when he's in the Red Bull, but with Toro Rosso, AlphaTauri, he's got that in his locker. So that could pile yet more pressure onto Renault. It looks like they've got a few little issues with the car they've got to get on top of. But yeah, I think the big question, we're going to be talking about this until they sign up for 21. What is the future for that team?
Yeah, Abitable says that, you know, they've got every indication that things should continue and that in principle they're committed long term, but principle doesn't really stand for anything, especially if the works team repeats its slump from last year. Even I feel like even finishing fifth in the Constructors' Championship would just be
would just be very detrimental to that team's future. But as it stands, you know, what if they get beaten by their customer team again, and they get beaten by a small team that's copied another team's design? How big a question mark is that team's future going to have over it? And I think, based on what we saw and heard in testing, I think the Renault seem to be better prepared than ever. They've got done more dyno running than before. They had a pretty trouble-free couple of weeks testing. But, you know, does the car look that mega? Does it look like it's got the pace to be a proper threat to the, not just the front of the midfield, but they've got to close that gap to the top three? And, you know, I agree completely with what Mark said about the fact that if, you know, they're working with a car that's been built by people that weren't considered good enough to lead the team going forward on the technical side. I've said that a couple of times now. So there are just all these question marks over the team. And even if they do continue, are they going to have done enough in the early months of this year to convince Ricciardo? Is Ricciardo going to be capable of fighting for sevenths and eighths at the start of the season, right the way through to the summer? And is he going to settle for that? So lots of question marks. I feel like however tight that midfield is and however much there is the opportunity for different teams to enjoy some success there, I feel like no team in that midfield has as much pressure on it as Renault does right now.
Yeah, we're going to be talking about Renault a lot this season. I think there's some big question marks there. And I think for the good of Formula One, we'd like to see them, you know, pulling through and performing well. It's one of the teams that should have the potential to work its way across to that big three over time. And of course, McLaren's trying to do that. They've changed a few things on their car to try and unlock more performance to explore. Obviously, you've got Racing Point very upwardly mobile there. There are, of course, a few other teams in the midfield. We've touched on four of them. We've got this, what we've kind of tentatively got as the three at the back of the midfield, but it's so close it wouldn't take much to change that. We've got Alfa Romeo, we've got Haas, and we've got Williams. Mark, Alfa Romeo seemed a little bit concerning at times in testing. It wasn't bad, and there were some flashy times in the early days of testing, certainly, but yeah, sort of slipped back. Where do we think they are? They seem to be treading water a little bit in terms of their performance.
I think they're a little bit behind the curve in terms of readiness. I think they still have quite a slow turnaround in production. So they've got a great wind tunnel there, and it's been expanded. But they still seem to be struggling to get the pieces on the car quickly. They turned up with some new pieces in the second week, which didn't seem to work. So I think it's not buzzing yet. It's Frédéric Vasseur's had to sort of rebuild that team because it was really down to the threads, and it's taken a while. And I think there was a bit of a misleading picture from 2 years ago when you had Leclerc occasionally as a rookie doing these amazing performances and occasionally fighting for the best of the rest position. But I think that was more him than the car or the team. And I think now you don't have an outstanding performer. And now you've got two perfectly good drivers in Raikkonen and Giovinazzi. But I think it's at a position where it really needs a driver who can squeeze an extra couple of tenths out when it comes to it. And I don't think they have that at the moment because it's just not quite there. The car doesn't... It looked okay, but... okay is not really going to cut it even for the head of the midfield. It's got everything's in place for the in terms of the facilities and the management. It's there to be put together, but I don't think it's together yet.
Yeah, I think I'd agree with that with Alfa Romeo. And the point about the drivers is a valid one. I think Raikkonen is a very good, consistent, dependable performer. He lacks that edge of magic that he once had. Good precise feedback as well, which means he's valuable. But and you've got Antonio Giovinazzi, who is a good driver, but he was frustratingly erratic and just too many little errors last year. And yep, he'd had 2 years basically out of racing. He'd only turned out, I think, did a couple of Grand Prix in Le Mans basically in the 2 years before. But we need to see him, you know, consistently nailing it in order to get that team to a point where it's delivering points. But Scott, what do you make of Williams? We know they're a lot better. They're at least in the mix. They're not an embarrassment, as frankly they were last year. But George Russell said that they're definitely the slowest car. Do you think we're expecting that to still be the case, or are they close enough to make a real fight of it?
Well, I think they can still be the slowest car and make a fight of it, because that was the big problem last year, wasn't it? It's F1 is so competitive nowadays, and when you try and stick to that old school traditional way of going racing and you don't have the budget or the people that can really do the job with it, there's no shame in being the last of the 10 when you're at an elite level. The problem is when you're a distant last. And from what we've seen in testing, I would say that Williams is certainly in the mix at the lower end of the midfield. And when you've got a driver like George Russell on the books as well, I think they've got the potential for the odd starring role. I think George said not to expect Q2s and Q3s at the start of the year, but I don't know. I don't know about the two of you, but I'd be a little bit disappointed if I didn't see George at least maybe having a stab at getting into Q2 in Australia. Maybe I'm going the other way and I'm setting them slightly too high expectations, but I would like to see George have a genuine opportunity to qualify not on the back row of the grid. I think Latifi's just a bit too inexperienced and lost a bit of running during testing with various little dramas. So I think Russell is their big chance, obviously, second year and a top class talent. I'd just love to see him not just fighting exclusively for 19th on the grid.
He should be able to do it, shouldn't he, Mark? If that car is in the mix, yeah, there will be days when you can haul it up there.
Yeah. It's a car that looks maybe, if it is the slowest, it's not by much. It's maybe by a tenth or so. So that's enough to, when you get a different set of circumstances or when you get an overperformance from a driver, to allow it to do something a bit eye-catching. And I think George is fully capable of doing that. I'd be surprised if we didn't see him occasionally in Q2. They've had the really low-hanging fruit is got them from last year's performance to this year's. I mean, it's relative to the competition, they've made up a huge amount, more than any other team, but that's because last year's was so bad. I mean, if they made up the same amount of performance next year as they made this year, they'd be up at the front with Mercedes. So that's probably not going to happen. So, but I think it gets tougher from here for Williams, but at least it's no longer embarrassing. It will be there pitching with other teams. It will be racing other teams rather than just two Williams drivers racing each other, you know, half a lap behind.
Yeah, I think a successful season for Williams this year will be a respectable last. Don't be an embarrassing last, and that's enough. I mean, for a team of that heritage and that name, that might sound not very ambitious, but they need to just be okay this year and then try and do something with the 21 project that allows them to leap forward, which is going to be a bit of a challenge. The one team we haven't mentioned is Haas, who had a deeply weird season last season. Quite a low profile in pre-season testing. Again, a few little flashes that suggested they might be able to really make something of themselves in the midfield. But overall, it's more about have they eliminated their problems of last year. What do you think of Haas, Mark? They strike me as a team that I wouldn't be completely surprised if they suddenly sneak into Q3 in Australia, but I equally wouldn't be at all surprised if they fell in Q1 either.
Yeah, I mean, historically, they're very good. There's something in the DNA of that car, of their cars, that works very well in Melbourne. So I wouldn't be at all surprised. But as you say, very low key, couple of weeks testing. Bit Ferrari-like, and they seem to be concentrating on just getting a minute, a very small grain understanding of exactly what's going on with the car and trying to fully understand it rather than even looking at what everybody else is doing. And it's quite understandable after the nightmare of last year. So, I think hopefully they won't be thrown a curved ball, which they were last year, and just one of those things that was an unusual trait in the car, but they were so small a team in terms of their resources and depth that it took best part of the season to discover what it was that was having them over. So as long as everything goes smoothly and there's no ghost in the machine to trip them up, I can see them regularly being upper end of that midfield group.
Yeah, well, we know when things go right there, it's a good little team. And I think, again, the baseline summary of the midfield is it's going to be quite tight again. and hopefully we will see days where everyone's in good shape and we can see a good battle in that area of the field. I guess one brief thing we should address is the whole question of the 2020 versus 21 development. Obviously, Mark, there's a lot of work to be done with the new 21 cars, so that is going to have an impact on the development war this year, in that most teams will want to get their upgrades out of the way in the first half of the season and then be 100% on 21 unless they have to change because of the battle of the situation. Do you think that 21 project is going to have quite a big impact on what we see in terms of team progress over the year?
Yeah, I think it will probably see less development from beginning of the season to end, and then traditionally we'll still see some. And obviously there's always the temptation when you're fighting for a place in the Constructors' Championship that's worth a lot of money to prioritise the now over the future. So there's always that opposing pull. I can picture maybe the top teams being more comfortable with having the resources to do both. And probably seeing that gap between the top three and the others opening out as the season goes on because of that.
Yep, I think that's going to be the case. It's going to be difficult for a team if they're in a bit of a close fight to work out whether they carry on a little bit with the 20 car or not. So that's going to be the main challenge, I guess. But that'll be just sort of bubbling along in the background on one of the underlying stories of the season. Well, we've given a bit of an overview of the teams, and now I think this is the first time you've been exposed to this, Mark, on the podcast. But we are now going to, against my better judgment, hand over to Scott for what we call Scott's People, where he comes up with a nonsense question and throws it out into the world. So with a due sense of dread, take it away, Scott.
I don't think it's nonsense. I think this is a continuation of a question that we asked before the second week of testing, which had just a crazy number of people get in touch. And I'll actually start. I'll ask Mark the question, actually, and see what he comes up with. So, Mark, the question was, if you could own any car from F1 history, what would it be and why? So that's what I put out to our legion of listeners and readers. But before I read off a few more that I've had since we did the last episode, what would your car be and why?
I'm a Bia Ligier JS11 from 1979, just because it's gorgeous and because it was such a shock to see that team suddenly dominate the first two races of that season after just being, you know, nearly there for a couple of years.
Fantastic. Ed, you'd never actually committed to an answer when we did the last one. Gary Anderson said it would be one of a couple of Jordans, I think, if I remember correctly. The two that he was particularly proud of, sort of his involvement with and how overreaching it was. But you dodged the question. You never actually committed an answer.
Well, my default answer is I do like the Eiffeland E21, but that one's been magnificently restored and in the UK, and somebody does actually own that one. I think I mentioned it last time. I would quite like a March 881, just because I think that's such a significant car, and I just think that would be a good one to have there and say, right, there's a car that you can say in 1988 is the future of Formula One. There's a straight line from that car, actually, I would argue, all the way through to today in terms of that heralded the real, real aero era, should we say, and that was Adrian Newey, of course. So that's why I think that car's so important, even though it only had a few moments where it was really able to show. But it was that there were moments when it was bothering, very occasionally, McLaren in that year, even.
Yeah, it was interesting talking to him about that car. He said that because he'd been working in IndyCar for a couple of seasons, and where the aero efficiency was incredibly important, obviously running on the ovals. And so the teams over there were getting a lot of detail on that. Whereas he said, when you come back to Formula One, it was just about horsepower, and everybody was just getting more and more power from the turbos and putting bigger wings on, and they'd sort of forgotten about the niceties of aero efficiency. And he just rethought the whole thing. He looked at those, even the cars that were doing and winning, the McLarens and the Ferraris before that. He looked at them and just thought, they're just big trucks. They don't need to be like that. And it was completely different line of thinking, and as you say, that you can draw a line from that through to now.
Well, this is why this topic is so good, because it creates talking points, and I had loads of people chiming in to just say that they thought it was brilliant that someone else had the same sort of dream car as they did. So I'll rattle through a few more just now. obviously everyone has a different reason for choosing their car. One of my favorite reasons I've got so far is someone picking the 1967 Ferrari 312, and the reason they gave is because exhausts. That's
spaghetti exhausts. It had the big exactly. Spaghetti exhausts, yeah.
And then another one from John Oriovitz. He has picked a continuation on from that. I don't think an F1 car has changed so dramatically by the addition of one letter. So we had the Ferrari 312 from Alex Ware, and John Oriovitz has picked the Ferrari 312 T from 75.
Yeah,
so beautiful. You add a T to the end and the car suddenly becomes dramatically different. On the other end of the spectrum for cars that looked good or, well, went quickly, I had two different inputs for the 1997 Lola, which, unironically, my favourite F1 livery of all time. It married all the team sponsors and partners in such a perfect way. That's from at 80 Wear Design. But they did add brackets, don't mention performance, which, you know, I think that's probably fair.
That Lola, I believe, isn't great value, because I remember last year speaking to Ricardo Rosset, who owns the Tirelli Raced and he owns a footwork he raced, and he did apparently look at the Lola, but I think it was not a great value buy, shall we say. So I think he switched on to trying to find his F3000 car that he took second in the championship. So maybe the Lola might not be the best value one out there.
I don't think it was particularly good value when it was a contemporary Formula One car.
It was
either,
great value from my perspective. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
It is probably the most money spent on a Formula One car per Grand Prix start. Oh, not Grand Prix start, sorry. Attempted Grand Prix start. So what else did we have? We had Juan Carlos Agoglia suggested the BT44, which I thought, yep, do you know what? That's perfectly harmless. Ewan suggested the 99 Minardi M01 just because of Stefan Sarrazin, to be honest. I heard a rumour that Stefan Sarrazin is still spinning on the entry to the start-finish straight at Interlagos after that crash.
I think if you got that car, make sure the throttle is okay.
Yeah, they definitely do not want that to stick. I hear that goes terribly. We also had a shout from Patrick Down for the Ferrari 641. Which I don't think that is a controversial suggestion at all. And then we will end with the suggestion of the Tyrrell 007, and that is from Brian. I'm not going to read his full Twitter handle out because it's a bunch of numbers. But yeah, quite a tasty selection. We had a lot more sort of older generation cars this one. When you missed it on the last time we did this, Mark, there were a lot of post-2000 suggestions. Which I said was just quite nice, because maybe that suggests that not this current generation of car necessarily, but at least cars of the last 10 or 20 years are still getting people excited in the way that sort of the older generation of cars did as well.
Yeah. I mean, it's there's less visual difference between the cars, but I guess when you as nerdy about it as a lot of people are, you pick out those differences regardless.
No, absolutely. So I would just request that for the next edition of this, obviously this is our season preview podcast. This might be a little bit redundant by the time we next come around to recording. But I've got a couple of variants on this occasion. I'd quite like to know, given the excitement around the Mercedes dual axis steering testing, I'd like to know the most random or coolest thing anyone has seen from pre-season testing over the years. And as we're gearing up to Australia, I'll make it a bit more topical, and I'd like to know what everyone's favourite season opening Grand Prix is. So you can either send a message to @WeAreTheRace on social media or at @SMitchellF1, which is to get abuse to me directly.
I'm just going to add a brief postscript to your question about the cars that they'd like to own, with the cars I'd least like to own, which would be either the Ferrari 312 T4 or 312 T5. I can't remember which one was responsible because it was dark, but when I was racing in the Ferrari Challenge at the World Finals in Monza, there were a lot of Formula One cars running, and I went into the garage next door in the dark because there were toilets in every other garage, so I was just diving in there. What I didn't realise is in the dark, there was one of these Ferraris. And if people can imagine the shape of it, the front wing is sort of very pronounced. Smashed my shin into it. And ow. So that's just the practicalities that you need to think about when you... is it going to be painful if you hit it with your shin? And I think that's one of the worst ones to do that with.
No, that's absolutely fair. What would be the best car for you to kick accidentally?
Probably appropriate the 97 Loader again. That's probably the right car. Something or a Life maybe, or an Andrea Moda. All my favourite cars, but yeah, definitely not the Ferrari. And although you could probably argue that the T5, which obviously was extremely uncompetitive in 1980 because ground effect moved on so fast, was a car that probably merited a bit of a kick. But the T4 obviously very, very successful. But anyway, I've digressed a bit there. I think we should probably call a halt to proceedings now. We have given you a bit of an overview of what to expect ahead of the coming season. We'll of course be there down under and at all the races through the year to bring you all the news and analysis. Do head to therace.com and don't forget the hyphen to read what we've had to say about things heading into the season. Obviously subscribe to the podcast and do check out our YouTube channel as well, where we've got regular videos. Well, next time you hear from us, we're likely to be in Australia, so we'll see you then.